Okay, let's continue where we left off before that. And we are in the middle or coming towards the end of the Dhammacakka Pavattana Sutta, the setting in motion the wheel of the Dhamma. And a very interesting discourse because it is kind of the starting point of all of Buddhism. And Buddha sets out the kind of the grand picture, the grand view of what the Dhamma is all about, what he has discovered. And it kind of sets in motion the wheel of the Dhamma. I didn't say anything about that, but the idea of setting in motion the wheel of the Dhamma is like a wheel that goes rolling, yeah? And the wheel has a certain momentum, and that momentum keeps it going for a certain period of time. The Dhamma is very similar to that. It rolls around like from one generation to the next one, one society, one culture to the next one, rolling on from generation to generation. Has a certain momentum until eventually it kind of dies out, it stops by itself and falls over. That's almost like the end of the Buddha's teaching. So this is kind of what the Buddha is doing here. He kind of realizes that he's now setting in motion this big thing, this enormous kind of movement in society, which is called the Dhamma and later on becomes called named Buddhism later on. And this is like starting out here. So this is kind of the first kind of exciting beginning of this whole rolling out the wheel of the Dhamma. So we had a look at the first noble truth, and we just saw that the five khandhas are subject to clinging. The five panchupadana khanda, they are called suffering. And of course, one of the things that perhaps didn't mention is that the five khandhas, they are roughly equivalent to existence itself. So what the Buddha is saying here, and this is quite challenging, of course, but what he's saying here is that existence itself, in the end, in the final analysis, when you look at it through insight, when you understand what is really going on, is problematic. That's what he's saying here. And some of these things you have to take on board with a degree of confidence and faith initially, because it's very hard to see how existence itself could be equated with suffering, right? Or some people prefer to call it unsatisfactory, that would be precisely because it is an insight. Sometimes you need strong words to make it clear that there's something going on at a deeper level here. And that's why I think suffering sometimes is actually quite a useful way of looking at the idea of dukkha. Quite literally, the word dukkha means something like pain, but of course in this context it is slightly different from that. So the five aggregates, the existence itself, on one level is considered suffering here. So let's have a look at the other three noble truths and see what we get out of them when we have a look at them now. Now this figure is the noble truth of the origin of suffering here. It is this craving which leads to renewed existence, accompanied by delight and lust, seeking delight here and there, that is craving for sensual pleasures, craving for existence, and craving for extermination. Yeah, so the origin of suffering is craving. It's something that you hear all the time. And the point here is that this word craving, tanha in Pali, actually in Pali literally means thirst. So it's a very particular type of desire, not just any kind of desire, but a desire is very powerful and strong and kind of all pervasive, kind of strong inner fire which drives you forward. Not any desire, because what this particular noble truth says is that there's only certain type of desires that are encompassed by this craving. Yeah, and this is kind of the important point here. But before I get to that, there's a couple of other important qualifiers here for this craving. And the first qualifier is that it leads to renewed existence. Porno bhavika is the Pali word. Porno is puna, from puna means again. Bhava is existence, so it leads to renewed existence. And this is, again, this idea that you see everywhere in the Four Noble Truths. It's all about rebirth, the idea of continuation after you pass away. It is fundamental to the Buddhist teachings. And I'm always kind of baffled when I hear people say that, you know, you're going to have to look at Buddhism without rebirth. It kind of completely baffles me. Because as far as I can see, it is everywhere. It is sort of permeates the whole thing. If you take out rebirth, it's like you emasculate the teaching. Then it loses all its strength, almost all its purpose. There's nothing really left anymore. As far as I can see, anyway. That's my view of that. But and here it is again, right, in the second noble truth, the craving that leads to renewed existence. And why is it so important? Well, obviously, in this case, if existence itself is a problem, we just saw that the five khandhas, the panchakhanda, are equated with suffering, equated with dukkha. Well, if existence is a problem, then of course that thing which renews existence becomes the cause of the problem. If existence goes on into the future, if it's only here for a few years and you die when you're 60, it's not such a big deal. Yeah, you can just kind of chill for a few years and then you're fine. But if it goes on, potentially forever, because the force which renews it is always there and hasn't been eliminated, then of course there is a problem. And that is really how, in the ultimate sense, that craving actually is the cause for suffering, is actually through the rebirth process. All other kinds of ways in which craving is the cause of suffering are really minor compared to that. Of course, we can say craving is the cause of suffering because when you crave, there is a suffering inherent in the craving and all of these kind of things. But that is very, very marginal compared to the big picture, which is really the main problem that we're looking at here. So this is the first thing, again, the idea of rebirth being such a foundational part here of the entire Buddhist teachings. Accompanied by delight and lust, nandi raga sahagata. Nandi and raga, these are words, I think delight is a good translation for nandi. Raga, it just really means desire, right? Sometimes kind of Bhikkhu Bodhi translator, you have to kind of feel around for different words that mean roughly the same thing. So he has here used the word lust, but lust is too narrow. It means desire in a much broader sense than that. It refers to all sensual desire, really. So accompanied by that, it just means that it kind of just defines the term, I suppose, a little bit more. And then this idea of seeking delight here and there. In other words, always looking out for delight, always finding new places. And this is the problem with the sensual realm, is that there is almost an endless possibilities in finding new kind of pleasures there. Have you eaten Chinese food? Have you eaten this particular type of Chinese food, right? What about Indian food? Norwegian food, but forget about Norwegian food. There's no such thing as Norwegian food, right? Norwegian food is just kind of that. But whatever it is, it's kind of this endless variety. And then you travel around, you travel here, you travel there, you see new things. In this way, you think that there is this endless delight here and there in the sensual realm. I like the way sometimes in our monastery, people, Ajahn Brahm gives Dhamma talks and he kind of gets really down on the sensual pleasures. He says, if you want to go and see the Great Wall of China, instead of going to see the Great Wall of China, just go up to the main road and have a look at the monastery wall outside. That's good enough. That will do for the Great Wall of China. If you want to see great forests, just go and look at the trees in the forest outside here. And it's true, isn't it? In a way, it's very true. It's very the difference between the way you see the Great Wall of China or you see, some ordinary wall somewhere is actually very small. Okay, the Great Wall is a bit bigger. It's a bit longer. Okay, and it looks kind of nice and all of these things. I haven't never seen it apart from pictures, of course. But still, it is a big deal, right? The Great Wall of China is not such a big deal. And one of the great teachers in Thailand, Ajahn Thet, he was considered an arahant by many people. He passed away about maybe 20 years ago or so. And he said that was the point of traveling around. It's just kind of variations on a theme. Yeah. A little bit different food here, a little bit kind of different sights there. And after a while, you kind of shrug your shoulders and you think, okay, what's the point of all of this? And you're just traveling around, kind of keeping on doing the same thing, going around and around all the time. Not actually going any deeper or getting any kind of real happiness. It's just kind of variations on the theme again. So this is the problem with it. You're seeking delight here and there, and there's no end to that. It just goes on and on. There's always something else to be done, always something else to be seen. And eventually you die, and then you start from scratch again, seeking exactly the same kind of delights in your next existence, whatever that is. So this is just a little bit about that delight, the sensual, the craving that seeks. Basically, it's about sensual pleasures, a lot of that. And now he defines it more clearly, exactly what he means by this craving here. And there's three types of craving that brings this renewal of existence, the Buddha says, in this particular place. And that is craving for sense pleasures, the craving for existence, and the craving for extermination. So these are the three cravings that are the problem. Yeah, sometimes people say that, you know, do arahants, do they have no desires whatsoever? And the answer is no, they have to have some desires. Yeah, if you don't have any desires, you don't get out of bed in the morning. You just lie there all the time. You won't last very long as a consequence. You never give any teachings, you never do anything. You never eat, you never go to the toilet, you never have a shower, you don't do anything. And this is if you have absolutely no desire. It's important to narrow down the field of desire that you have given up as an arahant. And this is what you have given up. And other desires have to be there to be a motivating force to make you do anything in life. And what is it about these particular cravings that is interesting? And what is interesting about these, in particular, the sensual craving, the craving for sensual pleasures? This is, if anything, is a force that binds you to rebirth and binds you to samsara. This is the most powerful force that binds you to these things. It is very powerful because it is very enticing, right? It looks like innocent fun, we're just enjoying ourselves. What's the big deal? Just having nice relationships, having nice food, having all these wonderful things. And it's very hard to see it as a real problem. And this is why it is so difficult. But it is, the point is that it is the one thing of anything that is the greatest tie to samsara. It ties it to the round of rebirth. And why is that? And the reason is because sensual pleasures, they are always concerned with craving and desire. As long as you have sensual pleasures, it's always about the future, about going somewhere, moving towards something, yeah? That is what sensual pleasures are about a lot. And because it's always about the future, it's always about going somewhere else. Okay, so you have your sensual pleasures sometimes and you kind of maybe feel satisfied for a very short period of time. But sometimes even while you are enjoying the sensual pleasures, still there is an underlying craving going on. So that all this almost unstoppable craving and desire that these things are, that these things come with. And this is of course is a massive part of the problem, because it means you're always looking to the future, always looking to something else, projecting yourself into the future. And this is then what drives that rebirth process. Yeah, this eternal projection into the future, never really coming into the present moment, never really allowing yourself to be as you are and be satisfied with what you have, never really feeling content. So this is why this force is so powerful and why it is so problematic. So this is I'm going to talk more about this later on, because this idea of sensual pleasures is quite hard to understand it, but I think it's very important to really get a good grasp of what the Buddha's teachings is about. Then you have the craving for existence, and that craving is even more fundamental than the craving for sensual pleasures. In fact, the craving for existence is what gives rise to the craving for sensual pleasure. The most basic one is the craving for existence. And because of that, that also gives rise to the craving for sensual pleasure. But it's easier to overcome. Yeah, once you have overcome the sensual pleasures and your samadhi is going really well, all you have to do at that point is kind of guide your mind in the right direction. And when you do that, it means that you can give up the craving for existence quite relatively easy. It is more profound, but by overcoming sensual pleasures, you have already overcome the vast majority of the craving for existence at the same time. Yeah, and it's kind of weird. I was just saying before that the five khandhas, they are really what existence is about. Yeah, so what we are doing, if the five khandhas are suffering, we are craving for suffering. That's what the Buddha, that's what really what this is saying. Yeah, if the existence is the five khandhas and the five khandhas are suffering, then we are really craving for suffering. This is kind of the paradox. And you wonder, how is it possible to crave for suffering? How is it possible to crave for something which is unsatisfactory, which is, in the end, it's problematic? How is that possible? And the answer is because of delusion, because of not seeing things clearly. because they're having a misapprehension of the nature of reality here. And this is why this whole thing of understanding suffering and its causes, it's all about insight, about understanding and seeing things in a new light. And only then can you really understand what is going on here. Yeah, so this is why it is so baffling sometimes, and why we only have a very partial view of suffering here. Even if you count up all the sufferings in your life, relationship suffering, work suffering, pain in the body, people speaking not unnicely to me. If you add up everything, it's quite a lot, but it's nothing compared to the insight you have when you see these things for what they actually are. Yeah, so you can't really add things up in that way. That's not how you get insight into the reality of suffering. Yeah. Anyway, we'll come back. We'll talk more about many of these things later on. This is supposed to be just a kind of brief introduction, really. And then we have the craving for extermination. That is when you really had enough. You had so fed up with life, and you just want to, maybe commit suicide or something, and you just want to end everything. Yeah. And then, of course, the terrible thing is that if you do that, if you follow that course, you crave to exterminate yourself, actually you are producing more existence in the future. Why? Because both craving for existence and craving for extermination, they are future projections. You're looking to the future, you want to exist in the future, or you want to exterminate yourself, that's also in the future. Now you can't, in the present moment you're here, so extermination is always about the future. Same thing with existence, you're already existing, so it's about the future. So it is projecting yourself into the future, and that's why it actually drives the rebirth process. And this is the distinction between the idea of things ending and things ceasing, which is the goal of the Buddhist path, and things being exterminated. Extermination is destroying some kind of existing entity, whereas ending is a natural process of things coming to cessation. That is what the Buddha's teaching is about. But the idea of extermination is actually not that far away from Buddhist ideas. And this is called Vibhava Tanha in Pali. It's also called Uccheda, which means to become exterminated. And the Buddha says in one of the suttas in the Anguttara Nikaya that if there is any teaching which is close to the Buddha's teaching, it actually is the Uccheda Vada, the doctrine of extermination or annihilation. That is close to the Buddha's teaching. Yeah. The other one is called the Sāsatavāda. It means eternalism, or the doctrine of eternalism. And that is actually very opposed to the Buddhist ideas. Which is interesting, right? So the Uccheda, annihilation, is actually much closer to Buddhism than Sāsata or eternalism. So that is the noble truth of the origin of suffering. Yeah. And then the next two should be fairly straightforward. Now, because this is the noble truth of the cessation of suffering. Yeah. It is the remainderless fading away and cessation of that same craving. Yeah. The giving up, relinquishing of it, the freedom from it, the non-reliance on it. So, here is the same craving we have just looked at, the craving that has to do with the rebirth that we're talking about here. And this is the craving you want to give up. And when you give up the cause of suffering, which is a craving, and you give that up, then of course suffering ends, right? It's natural that if you give up the cause, suffering comes to an end. So my completely, the remainderless fading away, and making very clear here that it has to disappear completely. When the craving is completely gone, then, of course, the suffering ceases as a consequence. And again, it has to do with the idea of rebirth, because it is exactly the same craving, the rebirth-producing craving that disappears. Yeah, and then you have all these synonyms here for cessation, the giving up. And I think the reason why the Buddha uses all these synonyms here is to make it very clear what is going on there. He doesn't mess around. He usually kind of makes it absolutely unmistakable what is going to happen. You give it up. You relinquish it. You're free from it. Yeah, because craving is also a slave driver. It is a problem. It is a pain to have craving all the time. So you're finally free from this slave driver. Now, what does it say somewhere in the Ratapala Sutta, where it says that we are slaves of craving, where tanha dasa means slaves of craving. And of course, if you are a slave, you're not free. So here you are free, which is the opposite of that. And you have a non-reliance on it. You give it up. You don't kind of hang out with craving anymore. And the word for that is analayo. Analaya is the word there, right? Which is interesting because he's going to come down here to visit me for a couple of hours on Sunday. That would be, I'll remind him of the Third Noble Truth when he comes there. And mind his name is taken straight out of the first discourse of the Buddha. That's very, very inspiring. And the idea of alaya or analaya is like a resting place. You know the Himalayas, of course, the Himalayas in the in Tibet and northern India, and that's from Hima and Alaya. Hima is snow. Alaya is like a resting place or abode. It's like the abode or resting place of the snow. That is the literal meaning of Himalaya. And it's the same word that you find here. This is one of the nice things about going to India. You see all the signs everywhere, right? And if you know a bit of Pali, you can read all the signs. Himalaya, Uttar Pradesh, Himal Pradesh, all these things, you can read them, not everything, but a lot. And it kind of takes you mentally into the suttas when you see that. You know that there is a connection there between the suttas and India. It becomes very obvious. And that's actually really nice. It's really, really cool because it brings the suttas alive, right? When there is a real connection, geographical, historical, it kind of makes you feel that these are real things. Sometimes when you read the suttas, I'm not sure whether they are stories or whether they are just kind of what is going on. But when you go there and you see it for yourself, it makes it alive in a very, very different way. It has a very powerful impact when you see these things. Anyway, so that is the cessation of suffering by giving up the cause. And then, of course, there is the noble truth of the way leading to the cessation of suffering. And, of course, that is the Noble Eightfold Path. Yeah, right view, right aim, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right stillness. That is the Noble Eightfold Path. So that is, there you are. Those are the Four Noble Truths. And of course, they are very, once you understand that this, once you have some degree of understanding of what these are about, you understand, first of all, that there is a problem. We know there is a problem already because we know that life isn't really that satisfactory. Yeah. And you think about life, you're going to do what everybody else does, get married, have kids, have a job, eventually retire, and then die, right? And you think about that, you think, this is pointless. What am I going to do this for? It seems so meaningless. I've got to live my life in a slightly different way from what everybody else does. Otherwise, I'm going to go down exactly the same way, make the same mistake, suffer in exactly the same way. Let me think about life in a more rational and intelligent way. Let me not just be another sheep following all the other sheep doing exactly the same thing, right? Let me be the black sheep in the crowd. Yeah, it's good to be the black sheep sometimes. At least if we do it in the right way. So this is so important to have a sense of independence in how we look at the world, to be able to see through the kind of illusion that the vast majority of people just go along with without thinking enough for themselves, really. So this is the first thing. You have to kind of start out with the idea that there is a problem, right? This is the first noble truth. And in fact, that problem is much, much greater than we think it is. We have some inkling that there is a problem, but we don't really have the full oversight of that. And then, of course, the second thing that the Buddha said is that there is a path that leads to the solution of that problem. And once you have those two things coming together, then, of course, you have a reason for a different reason for living. You have a bigger view of things. You have a kind of a meaning of life which is far more interesting. Life becomes far more interesting for you than it does for the vast majority of people. It's great to have that kind of purpose in life, right? It makes life so much more meaningful. Running around, doing all of these other things without having that bigger picture, it kind of impoverishes life. It makes it so small and insignificant and purposeless. But this gives you something big to live for, something powerful, incredibly useful and beautiful. And to me, it's one of the things I like the most about monastic life, is this feeling that I have is incredibly meaningful. Everything I do is meaningful. Everything is a step on the path. And also I have the opportunity to teach about these things at the same time. What a wonderful thing that is. It feels incredibly meaningful. And when I think back about the life I used to have before I was a monastic, it seems so empty by comparison. It seems so, especially before I was a Buddhist, right? When I kind of didn't know what I was doing, I was kind of wandering around in samsara, in the dark, trying to feel my way around, being really stupid, doing many stupid things in my life. I think back to looking, I think, oh no, I didn't do those things, truly. But I did do those things, right? And that is the problem. But this opens up a new perspective. It gives your life a sense of direction, an aim, a purpose, and for that reason, a meaning. And this is what is so incredibly powerful and beautiful about this. And this is, so it becomes a kind of a way of life and a meaning, and everything kind of falls into place as a consequence. So that is the Four Noble Truths, and now, based on that, I'm going to move on to another sutta. And this particular sutta is translated as ignorance into English, and the Pali word here is avijja, which is the Pali heading of this particular sutta. And this is another sutta which is like an overview. It gives us an overview of the path. We still haven't come into the details really quite yet, but it gives a very beautiful overview of the path. And it shows us how the result we want to get to. And it shows you that stepwise, going back all the way to the foundation, how that result actually comes about. So in a way, it shows you the Noble Eightfold Path in practice, if you like. But it's a slightly different way of looking at it. And every time you get a different view of how the path works, it expands your horizons about what is going on and how things actually, how this whole thing actually works. So this is what this is. This whole sutta is about. And what is interesting about this sutta, it starts off with craving for existence. Yeah, we have just looked at craving for existence a minute ago in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. And this sutta starts off with craving for existence. It says this is a problem. Yeah, this is what we want to get rid of. And it tracks it back through a number of stages and shows the root cause for the craving for existence. And then it does the opposite. It shows the root cause for the ending of craving for existence. So if existence really is suffering, as I was just saying before, then it's great to get rid of craving for suffering, right? So get rid of craving, and this is how it happens according to this particular sutta. So now we are looking more detail how to eliminate the cause of the problem, the cause of suffering. This is what this is all about. So before I start, I'd just like to talk briefly mention this word, which is here translated as ignorance, and the Pali word is avijja, and ignorance is kind of okay as a translation, but it's not ideal. And the word, the Pali word, actually is the vijja means actually understanding. It means real insight into the nature of reality. So avijja is the opposite of insight, and because it is the opposite of insight, it really means delusion. That's really what it refers to. It's a misapprehension of reality, a misunderstanding of what things really are like. And I prefer to translate this as delusion rather than ignorance. Ignorance in English means like you're ignorant of something. It means that you are lacking in knowledge or something like that. But this is more like having a wrong perspective on reality. Having the wrong, not just information, but a complete mental distortion of what is going on. So it is much wider, much broader than just the idea of ignorance. So that is an important thing. And then we have, on the opposite side, we have then vijja, which I would translate as insight. It's often translated as true knowledge by people like Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi, which is okay, it's not wrong. But I prefer insight, because these are the deep, fundamental shifts in your psychological attitude and how you look at the world. So they are insight, that kind of, bam, wow, this is what it's like, yeah. Things are very, very different from what you actually thought they were before. So they shift your perception, they shift your idea of reality. And what specific things is it that are shifting? And the sutras often talk about the te vijja. Te means three, right? Three, te is three in Pali. It is in English, it's three, right? It's related to it. In German, it's ein, zwei, drei, right? In Norwegian, it's tre. In French, it's trois. Yeah, so all of these words are actually related to each other, all part of the Indo-European languages. Sometimes you can read the Pali and you recognize the word straight away. You know what it is. Te, vidza, te, tree. Anyway. So all many of the very basic words in the language actually are the same across vast range of languages if they belong to the same language group, which these languages actually do. So, te vidza, and these are modeled on the Brahmanical te vidzas, and there were the three knowledges that had to do with scriptures and that sort of thing from the Brahmanical tradition. And the Buddha then took those on board and used them in his own tradition. He said that the te vidza of the Brahmins are actually irrelevant. They don't really say anything about reality. The real te vidza is an insight into the nature of existence. And what are those three? And they are, again, knowledge or insight into your past lives. Yeah, this is the first one. So again, this idea of past lives. Here it is a true knowledge or the insight, which is like the root demolishing of delusion, delusion about existence. The second one is understanding how beings arise and pass away in accordance with karma. So it's really about understanding the laws of karma. And the last one is the insight which brings about arahantship, the real insight that, if you like, ends all the defilements and ends all the problems, and then you become fully awakened as a consequence. That particular insight, which is a full insight into the Four Noble Truths and all that sort of thing. Yeah, so these are the three insights on the Buddha's path, and very interesting insights. Very often when we talk about insight, we talk about insight into non-self, into impermanence and suffering and these things. And of course, that is very important. But on the Buddhist path, these three are often the culmination of the entire practice. In fact, they are very closely related to the three characteristics. They're not really separated from that. It may sound like this is a very different type of insight from having insight into anicca, dukkha, and anatta, but actually, no. These things are very closely related to that. And the reason is, of course, because when you do remember your past lives, you have an insight into dukkha. You understand suffering. You understand the world in a very different way. And the Buddha uses some very interesting similes to describe the kind of insight and what happens to you when you have these insights. And one of the things that he uses is the idea of darkness being abolished, the light being turned on. Yeah, so it's like we're walking around in darkness. We don't really see reality. We don't see things as it actually is. We have no idea what's going on. Yeah, it's like going in a room, fumbling around, trying to find a way, and stumbling because you're hitting something on the floor. And we just don't know what's going on. And then one day, somebody turns on the light. Whoa, this is what it's like. Yeah. And this is like seeing your past lives, or seeing, understanding this idea of life just being conditioned by craving and potentially keeping on going on endlessly in the future. Like somebody turning on the light. This is what it's like. And of course, when you turn on the light, then you can make proper decisions for yourself, because then you know where you have to go. You know where the entrance way is. You know, whatever it is that you have to do, then you can actually act on the fact that you can see what is going on. This is the first simile that the Buddha uses. Another simile that he used in the suttas to talk about the te vidza, which is also, in my opinion, a very beautiful simile. And it's a simile of the little chick, a small little chick, right? A chicken sitting inside the egg, right? You haven't hatched yet from the egg yet. And you're in the egg yet. And of course, when you are inside the eggshell, your world is incredibly limited. All you can see is the walls of your little prison inside the eggshell, right? And you think that's the whole world. And then one day you reach a certain point of maturity. And when you reach that certain point of maturity, you have to get out of the eggshell. That is kind of genetically programmed into the chick. And you start its little claws, right? Its little beak starts kind of, you know, hacking at the eggshell, and eventually breaking out. And the seeing of past life, the Buddha said, is just like a chick breaking out of the eggshell. Imagine the difference, right? Being inside the little egg and one day looking out, wow, this is what the world is like. Jeepers. It is slightly more complex than I had thought it was, right? You had this enormous thing here happening around you. All these people, all these various animals, and all the trees, the skies, all this weird stuff going on there. It must be extremely confusing coming out of the eggshell the first time and seeing all this stuff going on there. So that is what it's like. So that gives you a sense of the difference in perspective, right? It's a massive, massive, massive difference in perspective. Just having an idea of one life and having an idea of a kind of a continuation of life going along and along and along in this way here. It's really, that is what it's like. And of course, we can have faith in this, we can have confidence in this to some extent, but seeing it for yourself is of course far, far more powerful than just having confidence in these things. And that is why seeing this is so important. So this is, again, it is all about, this rebirth process. And then the same thing is true for the idea of the laws of karma. The laws of karma are really just the mechanics or the mechanism that drives rebirth, that decides where you get reborn, how you get reborn, how long you stay in that new destination, all of these kind of things. Yeah, so it is the mechanics of rebirth. It is something you don't really have any control over. You may think that you're, yeah, great, I know the mechanics, I can kind of, now I can manipulate the mechanics, I always get reborn in a good destination. That's what it may sound like, but of course the reality is that this is all conditioned by non-self. There's nobody in charge. Whether you are going to make good karma or bad karma really depends on all these external conditions. So in the end, down the line, you're going to be conditioned by the wrong kind of people. Yeah, you get reborn in a mafia family, yeah, triads, or something like that. And then you make massive bad karma, and then you're off to some terrible destination as a consequence. And you can't do anything about that. Yeah, there's very little you can do about these things. And so you're not really in charge at all. This just shows you the mechanics. And the mechanism is not something you have control over, because you yourself, you just, every one of us, we are conditioned according, our entire nature, our entire personality is conditioned by internal, all internal and external phenomena, which always have an influence on us. And then you have the last insight, which is the insight of arahantship itself. And what is that insight? And very interesting, the way that insight is described in the suttas, it's always described as this is the end of rebirth. There is no further existence for me here. Yeah, this is what the insight really is about. And that is the only way it is really explained. It also says the work has been done. I kind of think that doesn't really add very much. But the main insight is existence has come to an end. There is no further rebirth. That is the real understanding of the arahant. So again, it comes back to the same idea again. The idea of the rebirth and the problem that that actually is. So that is the idea of vijja in Buddhism. Just maybe so. So that is what this. This is just the name of the discourse. See, because we've only gotten to the name of the discourse. Okay. So this is. So anyway, so let's now see what this discourse has to say. So, bhikkhus, it is said the first point of craving for existence. Because is not seen, such that before this there was no craving for existence, and afterwards it came into being. Still, craving for existence is seen to have a specific condition. Yeah, so this is the introductory statement here, and it's actually a very interesting introductory statement straight away. The idea that the first point of craving for existence is not to be seen, right? If you go back into the past and you keep on going, and of course we have just talked about the idea of past lives, so the idea when the Buddha talks about going into the past, he means going beyond the ordinary horizon that we normally have access to, and keep on going, going, going. And as you do that, you cannot find the first point. There is not the first point of craving. If there is no first point of craving for existence, it means there is no first point of existence itself, because you have to exist in the first place to have craving for existence. There is no, you cannot find the first point for existence. It keeps on going on and on and on, back and back and back. And after a while, you get fed up. You don't want to go any further. You've seen enough. And the Buddha is said to have gone back 91 eons, looking back into the past. Yeah. according to the Sutta. I'm not sure how accurate that actually is, but that it seems to be kind of the standard way it is explained there. So long, long way into the past, and still he couldn't find any beginning to this whole thing here. And that is a very interesting way of looking at the world there. If you look at the vast majority of religions, what they are about, a very important part of religion is to give an idea of where everything began. Yeah, Christianity, God created the world in 6 days, and then he rested on the seventh day. I guess he was very tired after creating the world, probably quite arduous task, perhaps. I'm being a bit naughty here, so please forgive me for being naughty. So, Christianity had that idea, and of course that idea, of course, exists also then in Islam, all the Abrahamic religions. It exists in Hinduism, right, where you have different creation myths in the Hindu teachings. And so across the board, there is this idea of legends and mythology for how the world came into being. It's a very important part of religion. And if you go to modern science, it's also very, very much the same again. The modern scientific outlook is it all started with the Big Bang. Right? But how did the Big Bang come about? Nobody says anything about that. And I think there was some physicist who quipped that, well, just give me one free miracle and I will explain everything else. Right? The free miracle is the Big Bang. And then, once that is given, everything else kind of works out. So even science hasn't really explained these things in a satisfactory way. There are apparently scientific theories these days about, how the universe may actually have started from a prior universe, yeah? So it's very similar to the Buddhist idea of one universal cycle, one eon preceding another one, going back into the past. And there are such scientific ideas already, but they are in the very minority in the world. There's very few physicists who actually believe in these kind of ideas. This is the prediction that I would make, is that going by the suttas and the way the Buddha talks about this, I think science is going to fall down one day on the idea of a multiple universe, multiple eons, one universe coming after the other one, big bang, big crunch, that kind of thing. Yeah. I'll talk more about this later on, but one of the astonishing things about the suttas is how modern in outlook they are, even in terms of things like cosmology. You wouldn't expect that. You would expect the suttas to have all kind of weird stuff about cosmology, right? Because you would think they had no ideas about these things. But actually, the suttas have a very modern outlook in cosmology. And that is kind of weird. So it's worthwhile talking about, I think, because it's simply because it's interesting. At least I find it interesting. And hopefully you will do the same. So we'll see what happens with that. So no first point is what the Buddha says. You go back into the past. There is no, you cannot find a first point. And this is what makes Buddhism so radically different from almost any other kind of philosophy, religion, or even science in a way. The fact that there's no postulation of a starting point. Yeah, and it makes such good sense. Why should there be a first point? The idea of a first point seems so artificial. Okay, if God created the universe, that doesn't really solve anything, because then God had to be there. So what was God doing there? What was he hanging around for? So God was there. It just creates another cause prior to the other ones, which is unexplained. It doesn't take you anywhere. The same thing with the scientific idea of the Big Bang. So where does the Big Bang come from? Yeah, there is no kind of final explanation in that. But if you instead take the Buddhist idea that it is impossible to find the first cause, there's always another cause before that. It may be intellectually unsatisfying because you feel like you haven't really resolved the issue. But in one way, it is actually very satisfying because it actually makes sense in a certain way. Far more sense than, in my opinion anyway, than the idea of a primary cause that started everything out and everything kind of came from that. And this is one of the things I like about the early Buddhist texts. If you come to later Buddhist texts, things get a bit more miraculous and strange sometimes. But one of the things I like about the early Buddhist texts is that they are so rational in a very deep sense. And they make such good sense. And you can kind of look at our modern outlook on the world, compare it to these things, and actually it is very, very sensible. So,
This is just one example of that, and there are many other examples of that found in this particular text. So that is the first thing about this. And the second thing about this, which is interesting here, is that the Buddha doesn't say that there is no first point. What he says, rather, is that no first point is seen. Yeah, again, that is a very important difference. Because if you say that there is no first point, you are making a philosophical statement about things. You're saying something which cannot actually be known directly, cannot be perceived. Because saying that there is no first point is would mean that you would have to go back infinitely into the past. And of course, that is impossible. But so what the Buddha says, he bases himself on what can actually be known, what is the empirical evidence that is possible to have about these things, what you have actually seen. And he says, well, this is my empirical investigation of existence. I cannot find the first point. So that is what I say. Yeah, and again, one of those nice little touches, tiny little things, that shows you that the Buddha doesn't overstep what can be known. He tells us things as they actually are, and he doesn't overstep the mark. And this is one of those things that if you read some of the later suttas in later traditions of Buddhism, it actually says that there is no first point to existence. Yeah, so they make the leap from saying that no first point can be seen to stating outrightly that there is no first point at all. And that is where Buddhism has made the move from being a teaching based on insight, based on empiricism, to moving on to being a philosophy and being like, if you like, a metaphysic. It's a metaphysical teaching, which is about speculation about the past rather than actually being a teaching about what can be known. And this is one of the dangers about later Buddhism. You sometimes get those shifts where you shift away from the common sense of the early suttas, and it becomes much more philosophical again. So little things here that are very, to me, very interesting. Those little words that the Buddha has added there that actually makes it very makes some important points about his teachings. So no first point of craving, right, is seen. In other words, no first point of existence. No first point of samsara, no first point of the universe. These are just different ways of looking at the same thing here. And of course, from the Buddhist point of view, the universe really is just our experience. Yeah, the universe out there, galaxies, whatever, is kind of, okay, whatever. But from our personal point of view, it is experience that really is our universe. You experience things, and in the past, you have gone on experiencing forever. There's a nice sutta about that, and that is the Rohitasa Sutta, which talks about the universe being in this fathom-long body. In other words, it is experience that really matters. And that is what then goes on into the unseen past. This craving for existence, even though it has no beginning, still it says here that it has a specific condition. There is a cause for this. There is a reason why it comes about. This is, of course, very interesting, because if we can undermine that if once something has a condition, then there's also something that can be done about it. If something is conditionless, if something is like a rock, if something is permanent, like a soul, right, or God, or something like that, you can't really do anything about it. But if something is conditioned, then it is possible to deal with it, deal with the conditions, and you deal with the phenomena that result from those conditions at the same time. So the Buddha says, I say, bhikkhus, that craving for existence has a nutriment. It is not without nutriment. And what is the nutriment for the craving for existence? It should be said, delusion, avidya. So the reason why we crave is because we are deluded. We don't see things as they actually are. This is a problem. Yeah. So, of course, if you part of that delusion, as we've just been talking about, is not understanding suffering properly. So you don't understand suffering properly. Of course, we don't really understand that there is a problem there. Then, of course, you carry on. You keep on existing. You keep on moving on into the future. And you keep on desiring this existence. So So there's this delusion about suffering, the delusion about non-self and impermanence are, of course, part of that. All of that is what actually creates the problem here. As long as you don't see things according to reality here, you're going to keep on craving for suffering itself. That is really what it is saying here. So it here uses the word nutriment to show the connection between avijja and bhavatana, the craving for existence. And the idea of nutriment in Pali is called the ahara. Ahara really means food, nutriment, that sort of thing. So the idea there is that it's twofold. And the idea is that the nutriment is something that makes something else grow. Yeah, so if you withdraw the nutriment for something, it becomes weaker. It doesn't grow as much anymore. And secondly, a nutriment is also something which ultimately makes something exist. If you withdraw the nutriment completely from something, eventually it must die, it must wither, and it must fade away. So nutriment has this two double function, make something grow and also keep something into existence. Remove the nutriment, it will stop growing, and eventually it will fade away and it will die. Yeah, so this is kind of the importance here of nutriment. So if you reduce delusion on the path, you are already reducing craving for existence. You're taking away some of the nutriment that gives rise to this. If you eliminate delusion completely, you have completely eliminated the nutriment, then there is no support anymore for craving for existence, and craving for existence stops as a consequence. This is how the causal relationship works here between these two. Support and also a kind of pull, both the full support and also the support, just making it grow into the future. So, then, after this, we come to the next stage here, and the next stage now is, what is the nutriment for delusion? What is it that keeps delusion going? And of course, this is very interesting. Normally, it is not obvious that delusion should have any nutriment at all. But actually, it does, according to the Buddhist path. And this is very fascinating. This is something I want to have a look at in a little bit of detail. Because once you understand this, you understand a little bit about the nature of delusion itself. But it is already getting, I think, a little bit late to get into that. We've already been going for a long time, so I suggest we stop there. And we'll continue with the rest of the sutta tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. Okay, so that's it for now. So keep on having a good time, and we will see you again at 7:30 this evening.